Indians 101, The Law and the Land. My name is Tali Naaman, and I'm your moderator. I am the U.S. Director of Journalism to Raise Environmental Awareness, which is our independent media project, started in 1994. And we have a distinguished panel, distinguished not only for their accomplishments, but for their long trajectory of service, and especially for their generosity in volunteering to be here to help us as journalists with understanding the basics of jurisdictional laws that we need as environmental journalists to cover Indian country. So I would like to first start with an introduction of each of them, and then I'll make a few remarks and have them each give you guys a little statement, and then you'll have 30 minutes for questions. After that, we will vacate the room and go to lunch at the ballroom. And if we don't have enough time to pick their brains enough in this room, that gives us a chance to do it over lunch and in the hallway. So you guys are willing to do that, right? Okay. Yes, thank you very much for being here. And I would like to introduce to you Nedra Darling. Some of you already know her and love her. She is a citizen of the Prairie, the Band of Potawatomi Nation. For more than 15 years, she has served as the Public Affairs Director for the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs at the Department of the Interior. Before joining Interior, she established the nation's first American Indian Media Center at the Institute for American Indian Art in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where she directed and produced several award-winning videos. And next here we have Neil McCaleb, who is the ambassador at large for the Chickasaw Nation, in which he is an enrolled member. He has served U.S. presidents and Oklahoma citizens in numerous appointed and elected capacities, including, not least of which, is the Assistant Secretary of the Interior, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, 2001 to 2003. And we have Lindsay Robertson. He is an enrolled member of the Chickasaw Nation. He's no longer enrolled. They kicked him out.
He's never been.
This is baloney.
I have to correct.
Okay. Where'd I get that? It's out there on the internet somewhere. We better.
You're a Chickasaw by accept.
He's been honorary Chickasaw. Anyway, it doesn't matter because he's the faculty director of the Center for the Study of American Indian Law and Policy and the Judge Haskell A. Holloman Professor of Law at the University of Oklahoma College of Law. So his professional trajectory extends well into the realm of international affairs, and he is also an elected member of the American Law Institute and serves as a justice on the Supreme Court of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes. So I'd like you to welcome this distinguished panel. By way of introduction, I'm going to tell you a little anecdote, and then I will turn the microphone over. I am from Custer County, South Dakota, which is a reservation border town area next to the second largest Indian nation in the United States, the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. And so I was starting to do my journalistic career with indigenous and environmental stories at the Custer County Chronicle when I was 14. And after that, I went on to the Albuquerque Journal, which is the largest daily newspaper in New Mexico. And as I was telling Lindsay, they didn't have an Indian beat there. And they said, we don't cover the reservations. And because I wanted to, they called me an Indian lover. Well, I had to prove to them that Indian tribal government and Indian activism were actually, you know, a news beat. And so they had me covering federal courts. And there was all these lawsuits about the water, the coal, the uranium, the other minerals, all the natural resources. And they could not deny that we needed to cover Indian issues after that. So I established a tribal government beat. And when I left, it became a halftime beat for somebody who, and lasted, I was there for 5 years, and then it lasted another few years until that reporter died, and now they don't have one, which is typical of a newsroom. I don't know how many newsrooms actually do have an Indian beat. Just probably it's bad as the newsrooms that don't have an environmental beat. So it doesn't actually cause equitable coverage when you have a setup like that. But nowadays, there's a lot of us that are out here reporting, not in a newsroom beat situation anyway. So in either case, people, my point is that people need to recognize that this is a government that needs to be covered just like any other government, or even more so, since it's probably got a lot more powers than your state, city, county government in most situations. And with that in mind, I'll just pass the microphone to Nedra, who will answer your questions, your secretly held questions, about what are the tools that an environmental reporter needs in their toolbox in order to take seriously, to be taken seriously when reporting in Indian Country and editing stories on environmental issues here.
Thank you, Tally, and thank you, Lindsay and Neil. It's really great to be on the panel with all of you. And I want to thank SEJ for the invitation. I don't know those of you that were here on the opening night. Were several of you here? I was very impressed with the opening and want to thank Vicki Monks, who's in the audience, for bringing the traditional and contemporary Native Americans from this area to participate in the opening of a very important conference. How do you start out in this area when you're working with tribal nations? And that is to link with them. And I thought for people in the audience to get up and participate in dance with the tribes from this area was tremendous. I hope that what you didn't realize and that you realize now is that we're in your heart. So don't forget that. Through the drum, that's our heartbeat. You participated in it. Even if you didn't, you were sitting there listening to it. So we're connected. And that connection is a lot about when you're going out and doing stories in Indian Country, somehow you have to make that connection. And it all starts with us being of the two-leggeds. We're the two-leggeds, we're humans, and that respect and that interest has to be there when you're out there. And I know it is in your everyday work, but you know, try not to look at tribal governments as something different. You approach city councils, you approach your governors and other government forms in this country, and that would be the same you'd want to start out with tribal governments. And I'm always astonished, as many of the reporters I talk to every day, I get over 250 emails a day. I have a staff of five. Neil, who was my boss at one time, never got me any more staff. And Neil, they haven't done that since you left. So I don't, I'm not sure. It's not that he didn't want to. But he had a lot on his plate. But it's a very, very small staff. So I know some of you in the room, and I appreciate your patience. And it is a big area. And I think that if you stop a minute and just reach out before you do a story to the tribal nations that you're interested in or the ones that are in your own community, that's a big step. And I am always surprised that nobody thinks to do that. And you know, and then when I talk to tribal people and I say, they'll say, these reporters are really bugging me. Well, talk to the reporters, you know, get to know them. It's humans and that's their field. Your field is running this tribal government, or your field is, you know, being the elder, or you're, you know, the linguist of this tribe. So make that connection on a human level. But again, I think that for non-Indian reporters and Indian reporters in some respect, it's kind of a, I'm going to go in there and take this from you, and I'm going to write it, and then I'm never going to see you again. We're not used to that kind of a approach. You know, we're pretty much, if we meet people, you're breathing our air, you're walking on the same place we're walking. We've already made that connection, so it's kind of a continuum, and I would encourage you to keep that continuum because we live on this planet together, and we have to protect it together. And those are just some small things that, you know, I can say. Also, don't be the expert. You know, tribal governments have a lot on their plate right now, and they may or may not have the environmental expertise that you're looking for questions. Help along, you know, help along with the learning process. Some of you, most of you are very bright, good writers. You know, you might want to share back with that at some point. You'd be surprised how our schools are not in the best shape, especially in the more remote communities. Share your gift. The gift of writing is, as you know, in the field that you're in, it's a tough job. You know, reporters, where are we going to be? Or where are you going to be? I'm not a reporter, but where are you going to be? I worry about that. You know, how are we going to get the real stories to the world? These are very important stories that you do. And I just want to encourage you, if you're ever out there on a bind, call me or email me, because I don't have all the answers, but you know, I can help in some respect, I'll try. You know, that's the best I can do. On the other side of that, I do have a lot of tribal leaders calling me and saying, there's a reporter that's really bugging me. Can you do something about that? Well, that's not part of the federal responsibility, but I'll do the best I can, because there's obviously some lack of communication or something that's going on, and I'll do the best I can, and that's about it. But I just want to encourage you to keep what you're doing, and if you are interested in the Indian environmental areas, please don't stop that interest. Don't take the stance of stopping because you can't get information. From tribal governments, it's very hard to get information. Sometimes the information is not accessible only because of the lack of knowledge at some levels, and sometimes it's very political. And it might be a political situation that within the tribe that they're trying to do, but just don't have the opportunity to get it to their own members first, and therefore it would not be going out to the public at that point. So those are some brief things I can talk about, and I'd be glad to entertain some more questions later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Nedja. And Ambassador Caleb?
Well, I think most people recognize that Native Americans were probably the original environmentalists in this country. Because they lived on the land and lived off of the land and were wholly dependent on the environment, the immediate environment, for their sustenance in every respect. Even more recently, some of you are old enough to remember the old Jim Silverheels ad about littering, where he had tears running down his cheeks because of the abuse that the environment was taking. And that impression lingers on. But what I want to talk about this morning is not where we've been, but where we're going. Because for tribes and Native Americans to have real influence and real efficacy in the preservation and conservation of the environment, the thing that really changed the picture was the general recognition of sovereignty of the tribes and their control over the lands, which they own and still own. That didn't happen 100 years ago. As the senior person in this room, and I'll assume that by looking at your lovely faces, I've watched the sovereignty issue unfold in Oklahoma over the last 45 years. I was on the first Indian Affairs Commission, and I remember when the chairman, Vess Tinker, who was chairman of the Osage tribe also, started talking about tribal sovereignty, and the states didn't have any authority over the tribes legally. I thought, in your dreams, Uncle Vess. I mean, that just was not an accepted point of view, certainly not by the states. And there are still legal tussles going on in that area with the Chickasaw Nation and the state of Oklahoma. But it has evolved over the last 40-odd years, that most people give lip service to tribal sovereignty, if not outright observation of it. And it means that they have the authority over their lands to control anything, and the environment is probably the most important thing. But it's also necessary that they have the financial wherewithal to do something. There's a lot of people that respect the environment and want to protect it and want to conserve aspects of it, but don't have anywhere near the financial capacity to do anything about it. Well, because of the Indian Self-Determination Act of 1975 and the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act of 1988, tribes have moved into an almost financially independent role. I know that my tribe, the Chickasaws, have. And as a result of having that financial capability, they're able to do a lot of things in the environment. An example is the Blue River in south central Oklahoma, which rises from the Arbuckle-Simpson aquifer within the Chickasaw Nation and flows into the Red River, and is a very, very beautiful river. If you haven't seen it while you're here, if you have an opportunity to drive about 90 miles to the south and east of here, it's worth a visit to see the Blue River. But the Blue River is threatened, and so the Chickasaws joined with the Oklahoma Nature Conservancy group to, in a partnership, a financial partnership, to fund the preservation and the improvement of the Blue River. And we are right now involved in purchasing some 3,700 acres of ground that is it overlies the aquifer. Now, you may have heard something about this yesterday in the discussions about the Arbuckle-Simpson. We also joined with a number of communities and like-thinking people who wanted to protect the Arbuckle-Simpson because it's a shallow aquifer and it recharges very quickly and discharges very quickly. And under Oklahoma law, you can pump all the water you can produce out of groundwater. There's no was no limit. We were able, in conjunction with the Coalition for the Protection of the Arbuckle-Simpson Aquifer, to pass a law, Senate Bill 280, which limited the production of water from the aquifer to 0.2 acre-feet per acre that you own, which is the only place in the state that there's a limit on the amount of water that you can produce from beneath your property. And that was determined by the Oklahoma Water Resources Board and their research to be somewhat approximating the recharge of the aquifer. That's, I think, a classic example of partnership between non-Indian and Native American groups that was effective. And I can tell you there's a lot of private property owners who like to turn back the page on that particular piece of legislation and open up the Arbuckle-Simpson to exploitation. Water is an essential resource. Chickasaw Nation is locked in a lawsuit with the state of Oklahoma, basically over the sovereignty issue. The state of Oklahoma says, we have the sole and exclusive authority for all the rivers and surface rivers and streams in the state of Oklahoma. And the Chickasaws and Choctaws said, oh, we have a treaty that denies that. And in fact, the Enabling Act that created the, or enabled the Constitution of the state of Oklahoma, Section 1, first thing it said was the state, the Twin Territories can have a constitutional convention to develop a constitution so long as it does not impair the rights and property rights of the Indian people existing in the state of Oklahoma, as long as those rights are not alienated. Well, that's pretty clear to an old dirt and clod civil engineer. I didn't need anybody to explain that to me. But as recently as a couple of years ago, the state of Oklahoma decided to give a permit, had a deal to give a permit to Oklahoma City to produce 34,000 acre-feet. Now, that's a lot of water, folks, out of the Kamishi River. And our position environmentally was that can't be done until there's a mutual respect for the sovereignty of both the state and the tribes over the control of the Kamishi River Basin, and number one. Number two, that it won't impair the both the consumptive and the non-consumptive uses from the river, the consumptive being obviously what you need for municipal purposes and industrial development and farming, etc. The non-consumptive uses are the uses that are necessary to maintain the in-stream flows in order to maintain the aquatic life, protect the aquatic life in the stream. And those the issue was joined in federal court, and we're in a mediation phase now over that, trying to work out a solution. And that's all I'm going to say about that issue, because there's a gag order on it. I probably said more than I should.
Well, it's not your spokeswoman anymore.
Don't look at me, she says. Well,
Nedra had a big time keeping me reined in. And, you know, other environmental issues are less dramatic than the water supply, which is critical in Oklahoma. In fact, southeastern Oklahoma is the only portion of the state which probably has an abundance of water supply to sustain surpluses that can be transported out of basin. Some of our attorneys might challenge me on that, but that's my belief as a civil engineer. Most of the state is drought-starved. In terms of the higher plains in the northwestern portion of the state, will never have enough water. So protection and conservation of our water resources is absolutely essential for the future of the growth and the prosperity of the state of Oklahoma and all its citizens, both Native American and non-Native American. Chickasaws have also done some things environmentally that were, I think, kind of on the cutting edge. We were the first governmental entity in Oklahoma to launch a CNG, a compressed natural gas program, to reduce the carbon footprint of our vehicles. And we had a lot, 600. Governor Anitubby and the legislature started a CNG program, and we built two CNG stations, which were $500,000 to $750,000 in cost because there were no sources of supply. I started driving a CNG car 6 years ago, and it was a dedicated car, meaning it didn't burn gasoline at all. It only burned CNG. And some of your trips were kind of white knuckle in because there weren't a lot of CNG stations. You had to plan your trips pretty carefully. That's not the case today. We have a partnership going with OnQ, which is a major jobber, service station operator in Oklahoma. They are building CNG stations in their own leases as fast as they can. They have entered in a partnership with us where we'll provide them a lease for the land on our fuel plazas. And they'll build the CNG station and operate it. Tom Love, who's a Chickasaw, loves travel plazas, is also very aggressive in the construction of CNG stations. Oklahoma, by the way, is the first in the nation in terms of total CNG stations per capita.
Well, Ambassador, I think you've given journalists here more than enough tips. If they don't follow up on that, we're going to have to be ashamed of ourselves. Thank you for going a little beyond the bounds. Now, Dr. Robertson, Lindsay, let's get back to the jurisdictional things for a minute. What are we talking about when we talk about tribal sovereignty? How is it not a contradiction to have two sovereigns, like the United States and the tribes in one land mass?
Yeah, thanks, Telly. And I'll sort of work up to an answer to that briefly, okay. But I wanted to thank you and SEJ also, as Nedra did, for inviting me to participate. It's always a pleasure and an honor to be with these two. Nedra, whom I got to meet for the first time today, but whose reputation I've known, of course, for years, and Neil, whose reputation, unfortunately, I've also known for years and learning that Neil is an ambassador at large created all sorts of scary images in my. I'm not sure that they. Never mind. No, Neil. But I do want to say this: that Neil, I think, undersold himself when he said that he was there to witness the rise in self-determination. He was one of the main players in the rise of self-determination, not just in Oklahoma but nationally. And I thought that should go acknowledged. So thank you for your service. I am the, and I'm going to make a modest correction on Tally's introduction. My title has changed as of like a week ago. And this is probably the source of the confusion. I'm going to mention this. It really is a way of saying thanks from the field of Indian law to the Chickasaw Nation. Chickasaw Nation made a very generous donation to my employer, the University of Oklahoma College of Law, to endow a Native American law chair, which has been named in their honor, the Chickasaw Nation Endowed Chair in Native American Law. And I was honored to be the first recipient. We're thrilled that this is in place. It's the only endowed law chair dedicated to Native American law held by a permanent faculty member at any law school in the United States, and I think that means in the world. Hmm. And it means for the OU College of Law that long after my time, and maybe, you know, what may seem a faddish discipline as it is in lots of law schools, there will always be somebody at OU College of Law, dedicating their professional life to Native American law. And that's thanks to the generosity of the Chickasaw Nation. So I'd like to even invite a round of applause for that, because it's historic. So what we do in Indian law, and I'm going to pitch a program in a minute, but Indian law as a discipline is really focused. It's federal Indian law primarily, and what we focus on is helping students understand the very complex rules governing the relationships among the states, the federal government, and the tribal governments. And they've evolved over time, as Neil suggested, since the early 70s, mid-70s especially. The landmark legislation was the Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act of 1975. Congress and the executive have been largely supportive of tribal self-governance, and lots of statutes have been passed to facilitate the tribe's exercise of their sovereign power, which they've always had. And I'll speak about what I think that means in a minute, including in the environmental area. There's a panel tomorrow that includes my good friend and colleague, Tiawagi Helton, focusing on Native American natural resources issues. And I'm sure those folks will speak about this in greater detail. But since the 70s, the tribal governments have been integrated into the environmental law enforcement area, so that now most major federal environmental statutes, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, et cetera, include provisions inviting tribal governments to opt to participate as the principal enforcer of whatever the federal standard is or whatever higher standard they choose to create for themselves. And that's really sparked, I think, a growth in interest in tribes and environmental law. And if I were a journalist, I'd want to understand how that worked, and also recognize that not every tribe participates. Not every tribe participates in enforcing all federal statutes. There's a bit of picking and choosing, but it's really the tribe's call. And the federal government has a capacity-building obligation, too. So if the tribe doesn't have the technical expertise to regulate water quality, the feds are supposed to train them to do so that they can take on that responsibility for themselves. Sovereignty in general, to answer Tally's question, which I said I would do eventually.
Only two words for that now.
Yeah. Well, Neil, yeah, no. this is a term that gets thrown around a lot. As Neil correctly said, a lot of people say it doesn't mean anything. Some people say it means everything. So what we do as lawyers, and it has kind of a political significance and a legal significance, we deal with the legal significance. To me, the question of whether a community is sovereign is really answered by the question, does it get to do anything? And the answer there is almost always yes. So it is a government that has some sort of lawmaking capacity. And then the more important question is, where does it get the power to do that? And there are really two alternatives. There are governmental organizations that are delegated their power by some other government. So like municipalities get their power from the state government. What that means is the municipalities themselves aren't sovereigns. They're sort of subsidiary agents of the state government. The other alternative is that the government exercises its power as inherent power, which means, to use a water analogy I thought of when you're talking about the Arbuckle-Simpson Aquifer, it sort of percolates up from within the community. Nobody else said you can do this. Other governments recognize your power to do this, but you have the power because you are a government and always have been. Tribes fall into that latter camp. According to the United States Supreme Court and century plus of Supreme Court decisions, and always will, at least for as long as we're all participating in this stuff, they exercise inherent power. And that makes them sovereign. Tally asks how we can have three. The reality is we've got over 600 sovereign governments in the territory within the territorial limits of the United States. Federal government's one. Each of the 50 state governments are sovereign as a matter of constitutional law. They exercise power that belongs to them as separate governments. It's not given to them by another government. Which is why states' rights is such a complex issue. They don't work for the feds. They're separate, right? And the states' rights issue is, well, where are the boundaries? Which of us gets to do what? And that's settled in the Constitution. Tribal governments, we've got, what's the count? It's 570-something.
562, last count.
566.
Okay, but this is before, this is with the Pamunkey on appeal. Okay, and you would know.
Okay,
566 separate tribal governments in addition to the state governments and the federal government. So you can do the math. That's a lot of separate sovereigns. And as I said, what we do in Indian law is to figure out what the sovereign power that the tribes exercise entitles them to do. State sovereign power is limited by the U.S. Constitution. Federal sovereign power is limited by the U.S. Constitution. States, I should add, are also limited by their own constitutions and what they can do. And tribal governments are limited by their own constitutions and by federal statutes in some instances and by federal court decisions. That's a fairly recent phenomenon in certain instances. And as I say, that's a recent and controversial phenomenon. But in the absence of any of those limitations on any of those sovereigns, they can do essentially whatever they want to do.
Well, that makes it a little more complicated,
doesn't it? Oh, can I add one?
You were supposed to make this simpler.
Can I add one quick thing?
Yes,
which doesn't have to do with sovereignty, but I said I wanted to shill a program. So if you're interested, I don't know how many of you are, I'm thrilled that there's this size crowd here, how many of you are dedicated to Native American issues? Can I see a show of hands? Anybody? Oh, good. Okay, well, that's a bunch of you. All right. So law school is asking too much of anybody, right? So we started at the law school 3 years ago. We ran our first test class through an online Masters of Legal Studies program in federal Indian law and international indigenous peoples law. It's mostly Native American federal Indian law. It's asynchronous, meaning you can attend the classes at your convenience, and it's taken off like gangbusters. You get a regular, it's a master's degree from the University of Oklahoma College of Law. What we essentially did was to repackage our entire Indian law curriculum, and I think we have the most comprehensive Indian law curriculum at any law school in the country, and or certainly in the top two, and repackage it, reteach it for non-lawyers. And if you do two classes a semester, you can get the degree in a year, I'm told. And it's like a year and a half or 2 years if you do it on a part-time basis. We started with 10 students without any advertising. As soon as we advertised, we're immediately up to 30. We have a spring class starting. It's not too late to apply. We're expecting we'll probably have 50 at that point. And now we're just trying to figure out how to cap it. But we have chief executives from Arizona in the class. We've got mid-level tribal government officials. We've got lawyers taking the class who want to develop an expertise. We have some ex-journalists taking it because they always wanted to know this stuff. But we'd love to have a current journalist because you guys would bring a sort of recovering journalist. But we'd love to have some of you in the program. So if you're interested, you can contact me. You've got my name, or go on the law school website, and there it's easy to find information about the program. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all. And I would like to thank the journalists and other participants in the audience, too, because you all came mostly on your own dime and of taking your own time. And that's one thing that makes the SCJ conference so good, is that we're all here because we really, really want to be here, and we really want to learn and professionalize ourselves. So a lot of this information can be used for stories. I think we've got several tips for stories here already. And I would like to mention a few of the other areas that you guys have probably been covering, or, you know, to be indigenous environmental issues currently controversial, such as the Keystone XL pipeline proposal through the Lakota Territory, uranium mining in the Black Hills. The Lummi Nation is facing the idea of the continent's largest coal port on the northwest Pacific coast. You've got the San Carlos Indians in southeastern Arizona with a threat from a copper mine, and all kinds of things like that all over the nation, that if we have our questions answered about the jurisdictional issues, then we can really bring those to the public's attention. So of course, I'll turn this over to y'all now, and you can ask those questions that you've just been dying to get answered. Janelle.
I am based in Oklahoma City, and I'm kind of embarrassed to admit this, but I've been getting a lot of questions from people who've been attending this, what the difference is between tribes that are based in Oklahoma versus those in other states, because the dynamics seem very different.
Okay, so what is the difference between the jurisdiction of tribes in Oklahoma and those in other states? Who would like to address that first?
It's probably the authority,
isn't it? In other states, you probably will be able to see recognizable reservation boundaries. And in Oklahoma, it used to be all of the state of Oklahoma was, of course, tribal lands. And then now, after the rush of breaking up those boundaries, and I don't want to go into that because I grew up in Oklahoma, and I've just got a good feeling on this side of what the great things are happening here, but back in the history of Oklahoma, this land, of course, was taken away from the different tribes. And if you go back, you can go on our website in USGS for the Department of Interior. We have tremendous maps of, and we've tried to work with different tribes, historical maps as well as current maps. And you can go back and see how the lands were, how they are. And then to answer your question about particularly Oklahoma, we do acknowledge a what we call tribal jurisdiction authority here. And it's historical. They're based on historical boundaries. And I'm half Cherokee, so if you look at the Cherokee boundaries, that's 14 counties. Does Cherokee own everything in the 14 counties? Unfortunately, no. But we're working on it, like the Chickasaws. But, but you know, there are a lot of within there. You will see the trust lands and fee trust more likely is in this area. So you'll see that. So there are boundaries as such. Osage claims and comes to us all the time to say, yes, they do have historical boundaries as well, but they do have a reservation, a mineral reservation, basically. So it is designated as such for Oklahoma. If you want to add anything specifically.
Well, just that there's a huge environmental issue right now going on with the Osages over the development of the mineral reservation, which they have absolute control over through the BIA and its trust responsibilities also. But it's an issue that's very much on the front burner in Osage County and Tulsa, of course, because Osage Nation reached down to the north side of Tulsa.
Yeah, just to sort of amplify on some of those points, the as Nedra said, all of Oklahoma, of course, was Indian territory, little t, back in the pre-Civil War days. And then the five tribes made a strategic mistake of signing treaties of alliance with the Confederacy. And when they lost, the tribes effectively lost the western half, which was used as a relocation space for Northern Plains tribes and Southwestern tribes, a little bit left in the middle unassigned to anybody, went to land runners, essentially, in 1889. Some of the differences also, in addition to those that Nedra pointed out, trace to the historical circumstances of the five tribes that were removed to Oklahoma in the 1830s and 40s. The Chickasaws, Choctaws, Muscogee, Creek, Seminole, and Cherokees, because they were, they had, in many instances, attempted to adapt their cultures to match the surrounding cultures in Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi in order to stay there, and it didn't work. But when they came out, they had, most of them had written constitutions, they had, you know, they looked more familiar, so they were characterized as civilized. They were the goal that all the, you know, the crazy plains tribes were supposed to aspire to. And for that reason, since then, for a long time, they were treated specially in legislation. So, for instance, 1934, Congress passed the Indian Reorganization Act, but the Oklahoma tribes got their own special statute, the Oklahoma Indian Welfare Act. Congress passed a statute called the Major Crimes Act back in the 1880s, but the civilized tribes weren't included, right, initially, because they're special, because they're civilized. And the other difference is that when those five tribes removed out here, part of the reason that they were vulnerable or believed them or were found to be vulnerable to forced removal in Georgia was that the state of Georgia claimed ownership of the title to their lands. I have a book on this for interest I can tell you about later. But they so Georgia said, we own the lands, we're the landlord. We get to impose our state laws on you. And eventually that was enough of an incentive that these tribes said, we're out of here. When they got out of here, the removal treaty expressly included provisions for all five of those tribes that we do own these lands. So the five tribes are almost unique. The Pueblos own their own land because that was the rule under Spanish law. And the five tribes in eastern Oklahoma owned the title to their own land because that was a part of the removal deal in the 1830s and 40s. That means that their land isn't technically trust land, which we hear elsewhere, land owned by the federal government in trust for the tribes, but what we call restricted fee land, which is to say it's fee land, they own it, but they can't sell it without federal permission, which is the same as applies to trust land.
Just one clarification on behalf of Lindsay. When you said crazy plain tribes, you might want to softly say what that means, because we do have plains tribe members here in the audience. So,
I've been for years on the Cheyenne Arapaho Supreme Court, so I've earned the right, I think, in a certain way. No, the plains tribes, they're in the mind of the federal powers in the 19th century, at the time. So it's a bit of an anachronistic characterization. Yeah.
I quit referring to myself as one of the five civilized tribes when a young lady, Kiowa, who's, we were on the same program, very beautiful and was attired in a beautiful deerskin dress with great embroidery on it. I'd made my remarks, which put me to sleep. And she got up in this regalia and she said, well, we may not be civilized, but we're certainly more vivid.
Okay. Clara? So what is the difference between limited sovereignty and sovereignty as strictly defined?
Well, I don't think there is a sovereignty exercise in the world today that's not limited. It's often the difference is some sovereignties are limited internally. All sovereignties are limited internally. Unless it's a dictatorship where you've got a government that does whatever it wants to with no restraint. But I don't know that exists, even that exists anywhere. The difference in the tribal context is there are external limitations imposed. And the Supreme Court would say, has said really since the 1880s, that it's by virtue of the tribe status as a, quote, domestic dependent sovereign or domestic dependent nation. What it means in practice, which comes from the Cherokee Nation versus Georgia case from 1831, what it means in practice is that tribes, as I said before, exercise inherent power, which means they're sovereigns, but there are certain things that tribal governments are not recognized as having the power to do by the United States government. And I don't know that it means any more than that, because this isn't a concept that the international world has really participated in very much. And those limitations, they're a lot of what we do in Indian law is try and identify them, right? Because we advise tribal governments on what you can do, and sort of how tribal government power works within the federal system. But some things they do include, and some things that the surprisingly limitations they don't include. For instance, historically, the tribes have, since the 1970s, Supreme Court says, not had the power to prosecute non-Indians for crimes. Well, that has started to change. In 2013, Congress, when it renewed the Violence Against Women Act, allowed a recognized tribal inherent power to prosecute some non-Indians for acts of domestic violence against Native women. And I think that's the direction in which that's going. There is a limitation imposed on tribal criminal prosecution, since I'm there, in the Indian Civil Rights Act that initially capped their sentencing power at 1 year or $5,000 fine per offense, not per prosecution, but per offense. And that's started expanding. In the Tribal Law and Order Act in 2010, it was kicked up to 3 years per offense for tribes that wanted to participate, and I think that's moving too. So there are still limitations, but they're moving. The major limitation that doesn't apply to tribes that surprises a lot of people are the Bill of Rights provisions of the U.S. Constitution, people assume they do. Lawyers call me and they assume that Cherokee Nation, for instance, is bound by the Bill of Rights. It's not. The tribes weren't at the Philadelphia Convention. They didn't sign the thing. The Supreme Court said in a decision, Talton versus Mays, I want to say 1908, that the tribes aren't subject to the U.S. Constitution Bill of Rights limitations. Now, most tribes have their own Bill of Rights provisions. Some have adopted the U.S., but that's very different. And then there is, last thing I'll say on this, on the subject of constitutional limitations, there's a federal statute, the Indian Civil Rights Act, passed in 1968, that by statute imposes some of those provisions, free speech, free exercise of religion, right to assemble and stuff, on tribes. But the Supreme Court said that the Indian Civil Rights Act limitations are enforceable by individuals only in tribal court. And the tribe gets to decide what those words, due process, equal protection, et cetera, mean. So that's, is that a limitation? I don't know. So anyway, that's a long answer to a good question.
I just note that Justice Marshall, when he rendered the opinion which defined tribal sovereignty in 1837, said they were dependent sovereigns, which seems to be almost a conflict in terms, because sovereigns typically are independent. Is that right?
Yeah, and actually, I'm going to beat up on Marshall a bit more since the context in which he said that has really been overblown, it seems to me. This was Cherokee Nation versus Georgia, and what he was trying to figure out was whether the federal courts could hear a lawsuit brought by the Cherokee Nation. That was the only question. And in an original suit, because they filed the suit in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court had power at the time to hear lawsuits filed by foreign states against states of the U.S. And he was trying to figure out whether the Cherokee Nation qualified as a foreign state for purposes of what's called original jurisdiction, which is the federal court's power to hear that suit. And the majority of the court decided that they weren't. There were six justices. Two said they were. Two said they're neither foreign nor a state. And Marshall said, well, they are foreign because they're not U.S. citizens, but they're not really, oh, they are state, rather, because they are self-governing, but they're not really foreign. They're more, and he threw out this phrase, domestic dependent state, but I don't think there was no legal consequence intended to follow from that. There was no analysis. It was just there's something different from a foreign state for purposes of original jurisdiction lawsuits. It's not until the late 19th century that starts to mean something as a matter of law. Up till then, I don't think people ever question total, complete tribal sovereignty that's not subject to any sort of federal limitation. I think that was the rule until the allotment era.
And just to add, the VAWA Act that was passed in 2013.
VAWA is?
The Violence Against Women Act. And the inclusion of, I saw some squinch go up when you said that. Non-Indians, and I'm Prairie Band Potawatomi, a citizen of that. I'm also half Cherokee, but a citizen of Prairie Band. And this was such a great piece of legislation that passed for our tribe because for many years there have been perpetrators coming, to our reservation, committing crimes and then leaving, and there was nothing that we could do. And it's just not, oh, those Indians are going after non-Indians. It's we're actually treating felons as felons, criminals as criminals. And it's an amazing thing, particularly on women, raping women, leaving and going elsewhere and not being able to do a thing about it. And people have lived in communities near our reservation. And I talked to many women, and there are a lot of people here that would know about this, but an amazing relief, not only to the tribal communities, but to the communities in which these people have lived for many, many years. So an amazing piece of legislation. I was really, we worked hard on that, and a lot of Indian women, but as well as within the federal government. So it's an amazing piece to see this going forward. So much appreciated.
So are you saying that the Bill of Rights did not protect women, Indian women's rights, and that is why the law was needed?
Not that. It's just that we could actually go with the courts behind us and fulfill this to bring them back to tribal court to withhold or stand up for the crimes that were committed on our lands.
Yeah, the way the jurisdictional rules work, the states have no jurisdiction over crimes committed against Native people in their Indian country. So the only potential prosecutions were federal or tribal. And because the Supreme Court had held in 1978 that tribes can't prosecute non-Indians, that meant the only potential prosecution was federal. And the problem with that is there are only so many assistant U.S. attorneys, and they have the power to, as you all I'm sure know, to decline to prosecute. You know, they have to pick and choose their cases. And statistics were showing that the overall declination rate for a lot of U.S. attorneys' offices was like 75%. So 75% of cases, they're saying, we don't have the resources to do this, or we've got other priorities. And, you know, when you're like, we've got a tri-county murder spree versus, an alleged sexual assault on a Native woman in a reservation that's 300 miles from here, you know, you can see why the resources were being dedicated, I guess, as they were. Not that it's defensible, but there was an explanation for it. And what this does is to say, well, let's just let the tribes take care of these because we're willing and able to. And the statute made that possible. So now that tribes are recognized as having the power to prosecute.
Is there a sovereignty issue over the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste storage facility with the Western Shoshone? That is, yes, one of the top controversies that's been going on for years with the Western Shoshone jurisdiction.
The one person that's really knowledgeable on this can't talk about it.
That's really a DOI question.
And, we can't go into policy issues. Dr. Darling is here to help us with ways that we can get better contact and communications, but not so much to talk on policy. Yes, can I have your question?
Yeah, my name is Amy Gooden. I actually wrote my dissertation on that issue.
Oh, well, there you go.
When I was in New Mexico.
There you go.
Okay, let's have an answer from Amy Goodman.
But, basically, the real issues and the heart of that, that goes back to the Treaty of Ruby Valley in 1863, and the relationship that the Western Shoshone people did not believe that the treaty was ever officially abrogated on their part, that the Bureau of Indian Affairs actually played a big role in how that issue was played out. It's really complex. I'm trying to think of a real simple answer to get to it. But basically what happened is eventually the courts ruled that there had been a taking early on with the treaty. The best they could do was to develop a settlement. And then they developed the Indian Claims Distribution Act and tried to compensate monetarily for the takings, illegal or not, because they couldn't do the right or the wrong. That's a simple answer. It was really complex. So as far as specific sovereignty issues, there are a lot of different opinions on it. The Paiutes have a lot of claims on that issue as well. And the whole thing, it sort of, I think, started to diminish when Yucca Mountain was gotten rid of, but now it's coming back because we still haven't figured out how to deal with it.
So I guess we can have a comment on that from Dr. Darling.
No, I'm not going to comment on that particularly, but I'd like to read your paper at some point. But to you, I wanted to say, please email me, and I will see what I can do. And that goes true with any policy. When we talk about policy, I always have to have a solicitor sitting next to me. And I didn't want to bring a solicitor with me, to be honest with you. I wanted to be out here by myself. It's just, it's just unfair, but I'd love to have a side conversation with you and any of you that have particularly policy areas, because that's part of getting information to you and how we need to work together. And, it's just part of the job that I'm in, but I'd be glad to talk to you later. Don't want to just
question,
dismiss it.
Great response. Thank you all. I feel that I'll abuse my role as the moderator here to mention that the settlement idea is also what happened with the Black Hills claim. The tribes claimed that the treaty was abrogated, and the court found that that's true, and they should get a monetary settlement, and the tribes don't want that money. They want the land back, so they're still insisting on it. And that has implications for protection of environmental issues, because that's where, you know, the area that I cover at the Native Sun News. So it has implications for whether they should mine uranium in the Black Hills and whether they should have a Keystone XL pipeline through South Dakota. So do we have any more questions right now? We got one. The question is, what is some of the effects of case law, and what other case law can we expect to look at in terms of indigenous, that would have impacts on indigenous environment or?
Or other things, yeah.
Other
yeah,
things.
Yeah. Yeah, so here's how that works. So, and it's back to the limitations on sovereignty question, too. So, conceptually, tribes are sovereigns. They exercise inherent sovereign power. As long ago as the 19th century, it became true that tribes, through treaties, they weren't ceding their sovereignty, but they were agreeing not to do certain things that they could otherwise have done. Lots of treaties, for instance, include criminal jurisdiction provisions that say, like, okay, we won't prosecute non-Indians. We'll send them to you if they commit crimes in our area. So that's fairly common. So treaties, first way that sovereignty can be limited. The second was through federal statutes, and that became true as early as the 19th century, too. So I mentioned one. I use the same example. 1968, Congress passes the Indian Civil Rights Act that says tribal courts can only sentence people to jail up to a year, right, per offense. Okay, so that's a federal statute limitation. Until 1978, everybody assumed that those were the only two ways in which tribal sovereignty could be limited, either if the tribe agreed to it in a treaty or if Congress passed a statute that expressly limited it. And that's because Congress is the guardian, supposedly, over tribes. So it does these things in the tribe's best interest. That's the theory. In 1978, the Supreme Court heard a case called Oliphant versus Suquamish Tribe. That was a couple non-Indian guys who lived on the Suquamish Reservation, got a little carried away during the Chief Seattle Day celebrations, and one of them hit a tribal police officer, and another one got in sort of a high-speed O.J. Simpson chase, but it was high speed. And they both got arrested, and they were going to be prosecuted by the tribal court, and they both said, you can't prosecute us because we're not Indians. That claim went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, to the surprise of a lot of people, said they're right. There's actually a third way that tribal sovereignty can be limited, and that's if, and this is the language from the opinion, if the power that the tribe's attempting to exercise is, quote, inconsistent with the overriding sovereignty of the United States. Okay? And we don't know what that means. It doesn't sound very good. But that was the language that was used. And since that Oliphant decision, the court has become a player in defining the scope of tribal sovereignty under U.S. law in a way that it never was before 1978. And the subject areas in which we've seen decisions since then include, there haven't been any additional criminal jurisdiction cases, but there have been a bunch of civil jurisdiction cases, and in covering both types of civil jurisdiction, and the two types are civil regulatory jurisdiction, so that's like power to tax, require fishing licenses, zone, that sort of stuff, and civil adjudicatory jurisdiction, that's the power of a tribal court to hear a dispute where the defendant's a non-Indian. So I'm non-Indian, I get into a tussle with Neil and Riverwind. Can he sue me in Chickasaw Nation court? I don't know. We'd have to look to Supreme Court case law to see what the rules are on the tribe's power to exercise civil adjudicatory jurisdiction over me. And I won't go into the details of all of those, but those are the subject areas that we see. I will add one thing, which is the most, in some ways, exciting and important thing that has happened in Indian law, I think, in my professional lifetime. And it deals with criminal jurisdiction. After Oliphant, 1978, I think most of us assumed that what the court meant when it said that the tribes couldn't prosecute non-Indians was that they had lost the power to prosecute non-Indians, and the only way they could get it back is if Congress delegated it to them. And if it's delegated power, it brings the Bill of Rights with it. And I actually think that was the intent in Oliphant. But in the 1990s, Congress heard a case where it was one tribe prosecuting a tribal member of a different tribe, and the Supreme Court said, oh, tribes can't do that either. Right? They can't prosecute non-member Indians. Congress discovered that created chaos, and for a brief period, there were actually scenarios where if Neil went into Cherokee Nation and committed a misdemeanor against a Cherokee, there wasn't a sovereign on the planet who could prosecute him. That was the whole jurisdictional hole created. I don't know if you took advantage of that.
You did.
Yeah, you may have. But a lot of folks did. So Congress plugged the hole, but they plugged it not by delegating to tribes the power to prosecute citizens of other tribes, but by recognizing that as an inherent power. So they say the power to prosecute non-Indians or non-member Indians, all Indians, which Congress hereby recognizes and affirms. Now, that's telling the Supreme Court, you're just flat wrong, and we're not reversing your decision, we're erasing your decision. Can Congress do that? Well, the Supreme Court had a chance to find out in a case called U.S. versus Lara, which I think is the most important Supreme Court decision of the modern era, and I've said so publicly, because what the court said, to the surprise of, I think, just about everybody, including myself, was, yes, Congress has the power in the Indian law area to erase our decisions and to recognize and affirm as inherent sovereign powers to do stuff. And that changed the whole strategy. Now, the people who don't like Oliphant, and the VAWA reauthorization was the perfect example of this. Instead of saying to Congress, would you please delegate to tribes the power to prosecute non-Indians who commit acts of domestic violence against Native women, advocates said, would you please recognize and reaffirm the inherent power of tribes to do this? And Congress said yes, and we know that that's constitutional. So what this means is for all of these what we call judicial diminishment cases, so that's the non-treaty, non-statute limitations on tribal sovereign power, Congress has the power to erase all of those. And a lot of us who work in this area, you know, that's sort of where our attention has become directed, to try and persuade Congress to erase those Supreme Court decisions. And then we're back to tribes exercising full sovereign power, except to the extent they've agreed in treaties not to exercise it, or Congress has taken it away from them by statute, but there aren't a whole lot of those limitations. I've given you maybe the two major examples, and I think all that's really healthy.
Okay, we have 10 minutes to go, so we have more questions back here, Vicki.
I'd like to ask about one area where Congress took away some power from the five tribes in the Navajo from the tribes in Oklahoma. And we're going to be discussing this tomorrow, the Indian and Tribal Law Panel, but I'd like to get some background on what was called the Midnight Rider. This concerns the ability of tribes to be treated as states for the purposes of enforcing environmental laws, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and so forth. Midnight Rider limited that significantly.
Yeah, this was really sneaky and horrifying, and this happened during the Keating administration, and I talked with Governor Keating about it. I was working as a special counsel in Indian Affairs at the time. I don't think he knew anything about it. I believe him. I trust him when he says he didn't. Senator Inhofe attached a rider to an appropriations bill that said that let me back up and say a word about tribes. So I mentioned that tribes are integrated into the federal environmental enforcement regime. The way that happens is tribes apply for what's called TAS, or tribes as states status, under whatever particular federal environmental statute they want to help enforce, or they want to enforce. So Clean Water Act, Chickasaws could say, and have said, we want to have TAS status under the Clean Water Act, which means that we will take charge of enforcing the Clean Water Act in Chickasaw Nation, or Clean Air Act, or, you know, you sort of pick your statute. And the state really didn't have anything to do with that process. It was the tribe demonstrating to the federal government that they had the competence to enforce the statute, and if they didn't, then the feds had to train them, so then they could acquire TAS status. This rider that Senator Inhofe attached to to the appropriations bill that a lot of people, I think, didn't know was happening, says that in Oklahoma, and only in Oklahoma, no tribe can be accorded TAS status under any federal environmental law without the state's permission. And since then, to the best of my knowledge, no tribe has been accorded TAS status to enforce any federal statute in Oklahoma. You want a story? That's a story. And it really hasn't been discussed nearly enough. It ought to be knocked out. I mean, there are people in Congress who are prepared to do that. But it just hasn't been a high priority issue. I think a little on the background would be interesting to people. And I think sort of an advocacy for repeal would be important.
Mm-hmm. Well, a little on the background, as you might suspect, it was politically motivated. If you were to pick the most influential industry in the state, what would it be?
Oil
and gas. They were threatened by the TAS because if individual tribes, and there's 39 of them in Oklahoma, and their boundaries are extensive. If they could set the interpretation of the Clean Water Act or the Clean Air Act or whatever, then they could control the drilling and the handling of the waste from the drilling. And that was completely opposed to the oil and gas industry. And that I'm sure that was a part of the influence, and I'm sure, Representative, that's my opinion, but it was a political issue, and it was done in a political environment, not a legal
one.
Thank
you. I have a question at the back of the room.
I'd like to just follow up on that. Do you see any way that the Oklahoma tribes can challenge that in courts instead of trying to get a change?
I think it'd be hard to challenge through the courts. I think it'd be hard. I mean, Congress does have the power to pass that legislation. I could sort of hypothesize a legal strategy, but if it were me, I think a statutory amendment would be easier, faster, and cheaper.
Thank you. And what was that you had to ask? Oh, yes, we got it answered. It is a time up sort of thing here, and unless there's... One more comment here.
There's one more comment before we leave. And I just wanted to acknowledge a couple of people in the audience. If you haven't met them, you should. You met Clara the other night. Clara, I have the most respect for this woman because she does own and operate her own publication in a very heated reservation setting at times. And I try to help her when I can. And I know that I would love to help her more. But, again, it's tribes having to help themselves at some level. And she works tirelessly. So if you... want to, I'm going to count on you, Claire, to talk to these people as well, but if you have questions, you know, again, she's there and talk to her. And I thought I saw Jody Rave.
Jody's
early.
There, too.
Oh, Jody Rave is one of our outstanding Indian reporters on all facets, but I want to encourage her to get her book done on the Cobell situation. You got Neil here today. You can pigeonhole him and talk to him on the side. But Jody was working for the Mandan Hidatsa RCRA. That's the big oil boom. That's the new Osage in North Dakota. And she just got fired from her position by her tribal council about a week ago because she was getting information out to them about the situation currently on her reservation. And being a member of that tribe, what a hardship she went through. She's a tough woman, though, and we look for her to be doing other things around. And, of course, you've got Vicky Monks here, a member of the Chickasaw Nation locally, and does an outstanding job in freelance writing. And I got in trouble a long time ago with Vicky when I attended OU for – I graduated at Oberlin College, but I did attend OU. You for about a year, and I was studying medicine at the time, and took a lot of chemistry and classes here. But Vicky was doing her piece on Kerr McGee at the time, and as she was reporting as a local reporter, her tires were being slashed, and all kinds of things were happening to her during that time period. And I finally told her, I'd love to help you, but I'm pretty poor, and I don't have time and money to be replacing my tires, so good luck, Vicky. but again, thank you very much, and it's a thrill to be here. And you do have a hard job, and I always feel bad on the other side, but if I can do anything to help, please call me.
We hope you don't feel too bad. We like having somebody on the other side who's good. And I would like to make an acknowledgement to Jana here, who is the communications officer for OU. She helped us get our panel together, and she helped get a lot of other things together here, too. I have one more thing to say to thank everybody. Before we go in the Lakota territory, we start and end occasions with a Lakota phrase that's mitakui oyasin, and that it means all my relations. And when we bring that and we invoke all our relations, it's not just our human relations, us two-leggeds and our ancestors, but also the four-leggeds, the wingeds of the air, the fish of the sea, and the rocks and the grass and the insects and the air and the water and the soil, everything, we are all one. And I just want to, that's how we do our work at Journalism to raise environmental awareness, and I just hope that we can share that way of going about our work as environmental journalists too. Thank you all. Mitaku Yasin.